This episode contains sensitive subject matter that some people may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. In Manchuria, before and during the Second World War, the Japanese Army conducted numerous and quite horrific biological warfare experiments on live human beings. After the war, in a series of questionable decisions, including the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the recruitment of Nazi scientists, the US Army granted the scientists involved in the experiments immunity from prosecution. In return, the scientists provided the US Army with the results of the experiments. To this day, the Japanese government refuses to come into terms with the actions of its countrymen before and during the Second World War. They refuse to come to terms with the fact that their history involves the murder of thousands of Chinese, Korean, Thai, and Filipino people and the sexual enslavement of the so-called comfort women. In the next couple of episodes, we'll be uncovering the actions of Japanese scientists and military officials from 1932, when the experiments began, until 1945, when they allegedly concluded. We'll also look into the US's actions in covering up the horrific crimes and examine its motivations. Along the way, we'll ponder the question, how can you come to terms with a history whose existence you deny? Welcome to the show. If you like this show, get on Spotify, Amazon, and Apple and leave us a 5-star review. You can also get on patreon.com/societyofstrife and leave a donation. Any donations you leave will be used to further my research efforts. Each 30 to 40 minute story you listen to for free took many weeks and sometimes even months to research. So, any help I receive from you guys will help a lot. You should also consider sharing your favorite episode of the podcast or the entire podcast with your friends and family. Before I get started, let me answer the question you're probably asking yourself or Google. What is Manchuria and why have I never heard of it? Well, Manchuria is not a country, it is a region. In the context of today's episode, Manchuria is the region located in Northeast Asia, between China and Russia, and some parts of Mongolia. Manchukuo also refers to Manchuria between 1934 and 1945, when it was under the direct control of the Empire of Japan. I should point out that while the word Manchuria is used around the world, in history books and the like, it is not acceptable in China and much of Northern Asia, including Russia, as the word carries certain racist connotations. Out of respect, I'll try using the word Manchuria as little as possible, although that might prove difficult at times. If I had a choice, I wouldn't mention it at all, but since I do not have one, I apologize beforehand. Too much of our collective history contains demeaning words and names ascribed to us by people who thought themselves our betters. I wish it wasn't so, but unfortunately, it is. In fact, it is a trend that continues to this day. Before I continue, I'd like to apologize for any mispronunciations that may occur during this recording. I've done my best to learn how to pronounce certain names of people and places, but shit happens. Please bear with me. The word Manchuria comes from the Manchu peoples of northeastern China. The Manchu were organized into tribes, and one of them, the Jurchen, produced the Jin dynasty of emperors, which lasted from 1115 to 1234, and the Qing dynasty, which lasted from 1636 to 1912. And became the last dynasty of Imperial China. Today, The word Manchuria describes three Chinese provinces of Liaoning, Jilin, and Heilongjiang. As I said before, the word Manchuria isn't acceptable in Chinese society. Sadly though, the Manchu, including the Jurchen, have become a minority in today's China, with Han Chinese being the majority. Unfortunately, we all know how China treats its minorities, which is rather disheartening considering the fact that the Jurchen once ruled over the world's fourth largest empire. In the late 19th century, seeing the promise of Manchuria's natural wealth, Russians began crossing the Amur River in Russia's far east and entering the region. As Russia grew more powerful, it began to spread its political influence into the region. In 1898, the Russians forced the Chinese to grant them a lease covering Port Arthur, now known as Liushunku District, Dairen, and much of the Kwantung Peninsula in southern Liaotung Province. This region had the best climate in what was then known as Manchuria and was to be under Russian control for the next 25 years, with renewal options, of course. In the early years of the 20th century, Russia increased its control over most of Manchuria, even going as far as stationing troops at key points throughout the region. In 1904, the Russo-Japanese War began, and by the next year, 1905, Russia had lost to Japan. Just like that, Japan became the major foreign power in Manchuria. Humiliated by its defeat, Russia eventually surrendered its Kwantung leasehold to Japan. While all that was happening, the Qing dynasty, now falling apart, pretended that it was still in control of Manchuria. But locals were now realizing the truth, because partly of Han Chinese migration to Northeast China as they escaped famine in the southern provinces. It was this migration that would cause the Manchu to become a minority instead of the majority it had once been. After the Japanese took over much of Manchuria, they established the Kwantung Army to, quote unquote, protect its investments. In the 1920s, something rotten began forming in Japan's core, when their seemingly infinite supply of luck began to vanish, and the people began facing one difficulty after another. In the early decades of the 20th century, Japanese soldiers were sent to Siberia to quell the Bolshevik Revolution. It didn't end well. After that, the country was humiliated by its allies at Versailles, even after helping them win the First World War. It was this humiliation that would later see them join the Axis powers of the Second World War. Finally, in the 1920s, there were a series of financial scandals and bank failures. The devastating Tokyo earthquake of 1923, and as a final blow, Wall Street crashed in 1929 and kickstarted the Great Depression. All those events coalesced into one horrible decade. Japan's junior and mid-level military officers began to lose faith in institutions, as is expected during periods of financial hardship. To them, liberal democracy didn't work because it couldn't deal with social and political problems. And Western-style capitalism was a failure because of its inequality. Most of these officers came from rural agrarian communities and had seen what capitalism had done to the poor firsthand, with some families going as far as to sell their daughters into sexual slavery and prostitution just to afford the next meal. These officers already harbored nationalistic tendencies when they joined the military, but now it wasn't enough. They needed to go further. They needed to become ultranationalist. To solve their problems, they looked for guidance in places like Benito Mussolini's fascist Italy, and of course, Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party. As people who grew up in an ethnocentric society and saw themselves as ethnically superior compared to people from Asia Major, they had no problem with the hate espoused by Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, because they figured, if it worked in the West, why not try it in Japan? These hateful and frankly dangerous ideas found their way into Manchuria and the Kwantung Army. For the officers in the Kwantung Army, Japan had limitations, but not to worry, because they figured Manchuria was the best place to overcome said limitations, because after all was said and done, Manchuria was a wealthy region and quote-unquote racially inferior to the Japanese due to its diversity. These officers believed that once Japan was able to absorb Manchuria into its empire, the next logical step would be to absorb the whole of China and eventually Russia. Unfortunately, this belief would eventually become action. On the evening of 18th September 1931, Colonel Itagaki Saishoro, Lieutenant Colonel Ishiwara Kanji, Captain Imada Shintaro, and other junior officers staged an incident outside Mukden, now known as Shenyang. The incident, which would come to be known as the Mukden Incident, was initiated by Lieutenant Suemori Kawamoto, who detonated a small explosive close to a railway owned by Japan's South Manchuria Railway. The explosion, which was a false flag attack, was so weak that it barely managed to put a dent into the railway line. Nevertheless, the Japanese blamed Chinese dissidents for the attack and responded with a full invasion of the region. The invasion triggered a full-on war between the Chinese and the Japanese. The Chinese outnumbered the Japanese, but the Japanese were battle-hardened. By February 1932, the Chinese had lost the war, and by year's end, the entire region of Manchuria was under Japanese and Kwantung Army control. After that, the region of Manchuria became the puppet state of Manchukuo under the last emperor of the Qing dynasty, Puyi. Western sources seem to indicate that Puyi's first name was Henry. I'm not so sure about that, so I'll continue calling him Puyi. Due to the invasion of Manchuria, Japan would later be forced to leave the League of Nations, a step which many historians consider to be its first towards becoming an Axis state. After the Japanese took over Manchuria, the ultra-nationalist officers of the Kwantung Army were now free to practice their socialist and anti-capitalist notions without fear from anybody. At the same time, tens of thousands of destitute Japanese were leaving their homelands to venture into Manchuria with new hopes and dreams. But underneath it all, something nefarious was taking place. Some Japanese scientists with specific agendas and ideas were considering new avenues of research. Research that quite possibly couldn't be conducted in the homeland because no one would condone it. There was nothing special about Beiyinhe. It was just another small village that made up part of what locals called Zhongma City. The only thing of note was the fact that it was located on the Beiyin River and adjacent to a railway line that stretched between Harbin and Lhasa. Back then, Harbin was the principal city of Heilongjiang Province. Today, Harbin is one of the largest cities in the world, with a population of over 10 million people. It is the 8th largest city in China. As I mentioned earlier, there was nothing special about Beiyinhe. So, you can imagine the villagers' surprise when, in 1932, several Japanese officers, along with support troops, rode into the village and ordered everyone to pack up and prepare to leave within 3 days. Anyone who did not follow the orders would be killed on the third day. and all their belongings burnt to ash. The villagers knew that the Japanese weren't joking. They had seen them do that to several villages, and so they reluctantly agreed and left their village. The officer in charge of threatening a few helpless villagers to leave their village was a young army officer by the name of Shiro Ishii. Ishii was born on 25th June 1892 in the village of Chiodamura, Kamo District, Chiba Prefecture. He was fortunate enough to be born into a wealthy family. His family, as Chiodamura's largest landowners, exercised some kind of feudal dominance over the entire village and its inhabitants. So, in some ways, you can say that Ishii was born looking down on the less fortunate. And as he grows up, the effects of this kind of upbringing will become clearer. We don't know much about his early childhood and early teens. The only thing we know is the fact that, as the fourth son of his family, he received a traditional primary and secondary school education. He attended local schools in the Kamo district, and it was while studying in those schools that teachers discovered just how brilliant he was. Apparently, he had an extraordinary memory and could memorize difficult texts in just a single reading. Unfortunately for him, his brilliance didn't extend to his social life, as other students found him brash, abrasive, and arrogant. Whether this was due to his brilliance or upbringing, I cannot say for sure. The only thing I can say for certain is that most people who came across him, even during his adult life, thought he was extremely arrogant. By adolescence, however, his other side started to reveal itself. He was an ultra-nationalist. He was fanatically loyal to both country and emperor. It was due to his ultranationalism that he set his sights upon serving his country and becoming a member of the military. After he discovered his affinity towards medicine, he decided he would join the Japanese Imperial Army as a medical doctor. In April 1916, Ishii was admitted to the medical department of Kyoto Imperial University. Immediately after admission, most professors took a liking to him and his brilliant mind and gave him highly advanced research projects that would have been beyond most people of his age and training. Unfortunately, there was one thing he never learned while in medical school: ethics. In Japan, at the time, most instructors in medical school believed in proper training and instruction and didn't give much thought to ethics. They expected that ethics would come naturally to students when they graduated and entered a profession centered on healing. Also, the Hippocratic Oath, or any of its variants, didn't exist in Japan at the time. Whether a course in ethics or the Hippocratic Oath would have prevented him from becoming the kind of monster he later became is up for debate. Remember, he already saw most people as beneath him, almost subhuman. And I very much doubt that a course in ethics would have changed him. In December 1920, Ishii graduated from medical school, and less than a month later, he began his military training as a probationary officer in the 3rd Regiment of the Imperial Guard Division. 5 months later, in April 1921, he received his commission as Surgeon First Lieutenant. Due to his interest in medical research, Ishii managed to be transferred to the 1st Army Medical School in Tokyo and immediately set about manipulating his superior officers. Ishii knew that to get ahead, he needed to be one hell of a sycophant. Luckily for him, he had been manipulating his superiors all his life, and he had acquired a knack for it. His basic MO was to bootlick his superiors, while at the same time terrorize his colleagues and juniors. We all know someone like that, don't we? At night, however, he became another monster entirely. Like a vampire, Ishii was mostly alive at night. He would drink heavily and carouse most of the night away in bars. I think we can all agree that there's nothing wrong with that, as long as he could maintain his professional life. But there's a lot wrong with his other nightly activities. See, Ishii loved geisha houses and made frequent visits to Tokyo's red light district, where he was allegedly known for his interest in securing the services of only young girls who were rarely over the age of 15 or 16. So, not only would this guy become a mass murderer, he was also an alleged pedophile. In spite of his growing notoriety, Ishii increasingly came to his superiors' attention. To them, he was one of their most promising young officers, and in 1924, they decided he should be sent back to university for advanced training, which he did. Back at Kyoto Imperial University, he studied and did research in bacteriology, serology, pathology, and preventive medicine. Later, he was sent to Japan's Shikoku Island to study a new disease that had developed in the Kagawa district on the island. The experience he gained from this difficult assignment, especially in the fields of epidemic prevention and water filtration systems, would have a great impact on his later career. Ishii remained at the university for 2 years and finally received his doctorate in microbiology. After graduation, Ishii stayed in Kyoto after being posted at the Kyoto Army Medical Hospital. While at the Army Hospital, Ishii began identifying with the anti-capitalist, anti-liberal, ultranationalist views espoused by his fellow junior military officers. As he gained experience in the medical field, Ishii acquired a reputation as a medical scholar. He published a series of papers in scientific journals which earned his respect from his fellow professionals. But something happened that would change everything. One day, as he was keeping up with his scientific literature by browsing through medical periodicals, Ishii came across a report on biological warfare by First Lieutenant Harada that would change everything. Harada was a member of the War Ministry Bureau and attended the 1925 Geneva Disarmament Convention, which outlawed both chemical and biological warfare. In the report, Harada explored why Japan had signed the convention. At the time, over 1.3 million men in Europe and North America still suffered the effects of poisonous gas exposure in the First World War, and no one wanted to see the calamity repeated. No one, it seems, except for Shiro Ishii. As he read the text of the convention over and over, Ishii grew more and more excited. He figured that this was where his work had been headed all along. Following his twisted ultranationalist logic, he reasoned that if the prospect of germ warfare created such dread, then Japan must do everything in its power to create the most virulent germ weapons, as well as effective methods for destroying wartime enemies with lethal diseases. He was convinced that it had to be done. He was also convinced that he had to be the one to do it. Employing his connections with ultranationalists in the War Ministry, he journeyed several times between Kyoto and Tokyo in 1927 in an attempt to make a case for biological warfare. The military leadership at the time wasn't very receptive to the idea. After all, they had signed the convention and did not see the advantages of biological warfare, partly because it was extremely hard to control, let alone engineer. Frustrated, Ishii began a 2-year tour of inspection and study overseas in April 1928. Interestingly, no one knows who paid for the 2-year tour. Some historians argue that he paid out of his own pocket, but that's highly unlikely, considering he was a military officer and they don't just get to go off on their own for 2 years. I think, and this is my opinion based on what I've researched, that his ability to manipulate superior officers came into play here. I think he was able to convince one of his superiors on the importance, according to him, of biological warfare. I don't know which officer it was, but I think that he had to be a very senior one, most likely one of his ultranationalist contacts. After he left Japan, he visited almost every country on my bucket list. He went to Singapore, Ceylon, Egypt, Greece, Turkey, Italy, France, Switzerland, Germany, Czechoslovakia, Holland, Belgium, Poland, Finland, Norway, Canada, US, and even the Soviet Union, Prussia, Latvia, and Estonia. After he was done, Ishii arrived in Japan in 1930 to find that it had changed. After the calamities of the 20s, the ultranationalists were now in charge. Before he left Japan, aggressive expansionist ideas were shunned. But now, they were welcome. 4 months after returning to Tokyo, Ishii was appointed as a professor of immunology at the Tokyo Army Medical School. He was also promoted to major in the army. Apparently, his 2-year absence had done nothing to decrease his popularity among senior officers. As a professor in Japan's most prestigious medical school, Ishii was now in a position to lobby for increased attention and funding of biological warfare research projects. Because he wasn't one to waste an opportunity, Ishii constantly bombarded the Japanese high command, as well as colleagues, with propaganda promoting biological warfare as a weapon of the future. He offered many reasons for Japan to invest in such research, including the fact that biological weapons development was cheaper than conventional weapons development. He also insisted that if biological warfare didn't possess great possibilities, it wouldn't have been banned by the Geneva Convention. At the same time, Ishii was lobbying for the creation of a new department at his university, the Department of Immunology, with himself as lead professor and chairman. Whether the Imperial Army knew it or not, he intended for the new department to be the center for biological warfare research in Japan. Finally, his efforts paid off and he was granted the department. After that, he met the man who would help him unlock new possibilities, Koizumi Chikahiko. Like Ishii, Koizumi was a brilliant doctor. For a time, he had even served as the Army's Surgeon General and later became Japan's Minister of Health. Like Ishii, he also harbored fierce nationalistic pride and supported Japan's aggressive expansionist program. It is thought that it was Koizumi's indirect influence that led to the creation of the new Department of Immunology. Within a year after Ishii formed his new department, Koizumi was appointed Dean of the Tokyo Army Medical College. Immediately after that, he took Ishii under his wing, even though he found Ishii's nightly conduct at the geisha houses strange, if not disturbing. As always, Ishii continued to antagonize his colleagues with acts of selfishness, self-centeredness, and arrogance, but it didn't stop him from gaining the favor of Japan's most powerful military leaders. First, there was War Minister Araki Sadao. Then there was General Nagata Tetsuzan, who is reported to have intervened on Ishii's behalf on matters that would have ended the latter's career. Then there was Lieutenant Colonel Suzuki Yorimichi and Colonel Kajitsuka Ryuji. These powerful connections helped Ishii to move ahead with his plans for biological warfare research. Initially, he worked in the school's immunology lab, but in 1932, Dean Koizumi set aside some land behind his own office for Ishii's use. A secure two-story reinforced concrete building was already in place on the land, so facilities were readily available. Another building, measuring 1795 square meters, was built adjacent to the original building in August 1933. These two buildings would serve as Ishishiro's Tokyo headquarters until 1945. As he put all his efforts towards biological warfare research, Ishii started to see some successes. But to him, successes were unimportant as long as they weren't field tested. So, how could he achieve success? How could he be able to tell that the biological weapons worked? The answer he came up with was an answer that no moral doctor would ever even think about, not in a million years: human experimentation. But there was a catch. He couldn't employ such a solution in the capital. His colleagues already thought of him as more ghoul than doctor, and if he attempted to carry out the experiments in Tokyo, they would surely turn him over to the authorities. To solve the problem, Ishii turned to his powerful connections and admirers in the Imperial Army. Finally, he managed to get assigned to Japan's recently acquired Manchurian colony. On August 31st, 1932, Ishii and his friend, Masuda Tomosada, left Japan for Northeast China. Once they got there, they embarked on a month-long tour of the colony. Unfortunately, it is not known why they did this. Some historians think that they might have been scouting for the location of a new lab, while some argue that they might have been innocently admiring the sights in Japan's newly acquired territory. Whatever he was doing doesn't matter, because after his month-long tour was done, he did not return to Japan. He had more important things on his mind, and he was about to venture into something he couldn't possibly come back from. He was about to venture into the realm of human experimentation. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we'll follow Ishishiro as he develops his biological warfare program in Northeast China and commits atrocities in the name of science and service to his country. If you liked my narration, please get on Apple, Amazon, and Spotify and leave us a 5-star review. As a reminder, new episodes come out every Sunday on Patreon and every Wednesday everywhere else. You can also follow the show on Instagram at Society of Strife Podcast for updates. Until next time, goodbye.